Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. This classic episode was produced by the team at Pandora. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to QLS Classic Episode 57, Bootsy Collins, from November 2017. One of the most colorful creative forces in music, Bootsy Collins came into James Brown's life in the nick of time and gave him a burst of energy. He would later take all that energy and help George Clinton build the almighty P-Funk empire. The stories are outrageous, y'all. So please enjoy QLS Classic with the baby bubba of all baby bubbas, Bootszilla, y'all. All right, enjoy.
Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
My name is Questzilla.
Yeah.
And I am shy.
Yeah.
Don't play him cheap.
Yeah.
Don't let him cry.
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
My name is Fonte.
Yeah.
And I must confess.
Yeah.
The answer to the question.
Yeah.
Is very yes.
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
The name is Sugar, baby.
Yeah.
That ain't no joke, yo.
Yeah.
I got a theory, baby.
Yeah.
About Pinocchio.
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
Hallelujah.
Yeah.
They call me Boss Bill.
Yeah.
Not the friendly ghost.
Yeah.
But the Holy Ghost.
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
So ready for Bootsy.
Yeah.
I got my munchies and my sweet love.
Yeah.
Ah.
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema Suprema, Suprema roll call.
Warm me up.
Yeah.
All the name is Bootsy, baby.
Yeah.
And I got a request.
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
Best roll call
yeah,
ever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That trumps Charlie Wilson.
Yeah.
That trumps Charlie Wilson.
Yeah.
So, ladies and gentlemen, our guest today, in my honest opinion, is the spiritual epicenter of postmodern black music.
Oh, my
God. That's a lot.
No, but listen.
That's a lot to live up to, man.
Because, I mean, Bootsy Collins, in my opinion, is a bridge. Like, he ushered James Brown. All right.
Absolutely. No, I know where you're going.
His young blood energy gave James Brown new life for the 70s, and basically for that much, you know, because of sampling technology, 80s, 90s, 2000s, and so forth. Not to mention him co-piloting. Yes, cohabitation.
One syllable at a time.
As co-pilot of the mothership with George Clinton. You know, expanding our minds and pushing the boundaries of funk music, and dare I say it, Afrofuturist ideas, and creativity into millions, and not to mention, I mean, he's pretty much on the Mount Rushmore of G-Funkology.
No, absolutely. No.
There's
no exaggeration.
There's not much more to say than that. Welcome the one and only Bootsy Collins to Questlove Supreme.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Well, like I said before, I got one request.
What you got, bro?
Request love, baby. You're going to add that to the show, I tell you that right now.
I think I might change that to you know, Request Love Supreme.
Yeah.
You know what? I know most of our guests that come here, and of course that, you know, we've known each other for a long time. But there's one question I never asked you.
Yeah. Well,
How did you get your name?
Oh, that's easy, man. Mama looked at me and she told me that I look like a Bootsy.
Really?
Yeah. And I, you know, I started to say, well, can you tell me what a Bootsy look like? You know, and then something stopped me and said, well, you see how deep she is. So leave that alone. I just left it alone.
Is Bootsy on your birth certificate?
No.
Okay. Okay.
Well, actually, it was added, but she just called me Bootsy.
And just stuck.
Stuck. Everybody started calling me Bootsy. That was it.
And forever.
Yeah.
Okay. I assume that you were a Cincinnati resident, correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
You born in Cincinnati.
Born in Cincinnati. You know, didn't actually, well, at first we did a lot of work in Cincinnati at the King, you know, King Records. That's where we actually got started. Mm-hmm. With all the different groups and stuff that we're recording there, and then finally with James Brown.
So what was your childhood like in that city? Like, did your parents migrate to Cincinnati, or was the entire Collins family from?
Yeah. Well, I didn't get to know my dad, but my mother, she was from Tennessee, Pulaski. Tennessee, and then she came to Cincinnati, her and her a couple of her sisters, and I kind of grew up with my cousins. We all lived in one house, and it was pretty much ladies, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, ladies with the kids, and so, you know, I kind of grew up, we was just having a blast. I mean, it was just fun time, you know, not having nothing. You know, everybody's used to that. Funk is making something out of nothing. So, you know, it's like whatever we had, we dealt with it.
Well, assuming that you were a child in the 50s.
Yeah.
You're so timeless, I don't even know what your age is. Like, you still might be 24 years old as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, come on, quick.
But growing up in...
I still might be, come on, man.
Yeah, you pretty
nah,
much.
You haven't aged.
You haven't not aged. Age. So I know that for a lot of the pioneers of funk and soul that were from down south,
yeah,
their stories are definitely much more harsh. You know, right. James Brown's story, of course. Like,
yeah, yeah.
That's typical pretty much of anyone that lived below the Mason-Dixon line.
Right.
But because you're kind of part of the baby boom generation that had, you know, that grew up in the Midwest, and there were factories and jobs and all those things. Like, was your childhood similar? Like, was there still danger elements?
Oh, man. I mean, it was all around us.
So
I mean,
Ohio was always still Ohio?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Okay. I mean, you know, it was all around us, you know, but... we kind of came with, I guess, a new twist. The same twist you was talking about when we bought that new energy to James Brown. I think that's kind of the way we came up. We refused to go with how deep it actually was. So at that particular time, we were going with, it was deep. We was in the riots. I was actually a part of all that. The Black Panthers used to come down on the corner about a block from us. I mean, we was into all of that. But at the same time, it kind of, just like George Clinton and I did with Parliament Funkadelic, all of that deep stuff was going on, but we refused to react like that, you know? In other words, we made a little humor about it, where it was humorous enough not to be like taken like, oh, well, they laughing about it. You know, I mean, so it was a kind of silly, serious kind of thing.
Well, sometimes you got to laugh about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's kind of the way we came up with our situation, as deep as the situations was.
So how was music introduced to you?
My brother. My brother, Catfish.
Yeah. How much older was he then?
He was 8 years older. I was like.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought you guys were like close in age. I didn't know he was your big brother.
Oh, he's my big, yeah, he's definitely. That's the only man figure I had in the house that I looked up to that, you know, that I kind of wanted to be like. you know. Well, not even kind of. I wanted to be like
So describe Catfish. Like, how did he get the name Catfish?
Oh, I wore him out, man. I mean, you know, I mean, he looked like a catfish. I mean, you know, you look at him, you know, he had these whisker, you know, these little whisker things going on, and he had these big eyes, you know, and he just looked like a catfish, man. You
know? Wait.
Plain and simple.
See, I'm having... Yeah. Because most of these characters were introduced to me via James Brown.
Right, right, right.
I'm thinking like, yo, they got some funky nicknames. Like, I thought he had catfish sandwiches in his luggage or something like that.
No, man.
He looked like one.
Yeah. He just teased it.
Well, you know, now I'm finally realizing I understand what my mother said when she said I look like a Bootsy. Whatever that was, you know, I still don't know what a Bootsy looked like.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, but then when I look at it, I just said because he looked like a catfish. And that's the truth. I mean, there's no other explanation. He looked like a catfish, you know?
Did he appreciate this nickname early?
Oh, he loved it. He loved it. I mean, pretty much anybody that I would nickname, I mean, they wind up loving it.
Babyface.
I'm about to say babyface. Yeah.
And so, you know... that was a thing that I did. I always came up with, when I saw a person and, you know, if something hit me, like, oh, you know.
I'm and, ready.
Yeah.
He was looking at me. I thought it was a naming ceremony. I was like, what is my name?
Tiggs. Tiggs.
Like, oh, okay.
No. Melody, baby.
Yes.
You know, so, you know, and that's the way it all went down, you know. It was like... Catfish kind of brought the bands, you know, to the house, and we had like a two room house.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, my mother, she was into whatever we were into, and music. You know, she loved it. She loved, you know, that we were into music, and so Catfish would have the girls and. You know, the bands are all around the house, and I'm like 9 years old, so I'm loving it. You know, I'm like, okay, I got to learn how to play, you know? And so I started putting two and two together. I don't have a guitar. I don't have no way of getting anything. Mm-hmm. So when my brother leaves to go on the paper route, I'll just steal his guitar for a moment.
But was he a don't touch my guitar type?
Oh, he was definitely don't you ever, you know, and don't never let me catch you with it, you know. So I always knew when I get his guitar out of the, you know, out of the case to put it back exactly like
test
it was.
You.
Oh, like, did he test me?
Put a pick there.
Oh, yeah.
D2 the strings.
He tested me and busted me. You know, all it took was one time. When he busted me one time, I knew then that I had to get myself a guitar, you know, because he wore me out. You know? I mean, it wasn't even I was 9 years old. He wore me out like I was a man.
Damn.
So I said, okay, I got to get me a guitar. And so I started doing my own paper route. I got me a paper route job.
Was he not even the least bit curious if you could actually play or... The
you know,
Joe Jackson,
you know,
the Tito
how big
theory.
Brothers, you know how big brothers treat little snide nosed long haired suckers. Well, that's the way I was treated, you know. And,
I'm older than all these people in the room, but you know, yeah, I get it.
Why are you pointing at me?
I'm pointing at all of you.
That's how I get treated.
But you know, he first of all didn't think I was serious, because you know it's like the little young, you know, he gonna change his mind next week. You know, but I tricked him because, you know, once I got locked in, like, this is what I want to do. And, you know, and I just started showing people that's what I want to do. And Catfish was the last one that realized I was serious. You know, his drummer named Raunchy was the baddest cat in Cincinnati, man. I mean, and he embraced me. You know, he allowed me to come into their rehearsals. Cat was like, oh, man, get that mom out of here. Mm-hmm. You know, but Raunchy embraced me, man. And I used to stand there and watch him play, you know, and while listening to the guitars and, you know, and the band thing was just such a, it was such a big deal back then, you know.
What would they play at the time? Like, what type
of? It was playing like.
What year was this?
This is like. 60, what is it? it's like 1960s, 61. Okay. You know, I was born in 51, so 9 years after that is what? Like 60?
61.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. So it's around in that time.
So and right before the British invasion. So
right, right, right. So we was listening to Lonnie Mack. Dang, man, it was so much stuff. So much of the instrumental kind of music stuff. Curtis, King Curtis, Miles Davis. I mean, you name it. I mean, you know, all of that stuff was, you know, then you had the Motown thing. That was, you know, that was hot, beginning to be hot. And
so was he playing like Sop Hops and those things, like area, like were these bands, was your brother playing in?
Yeah. Okay. Every club you can think of, I mean, the Mugs was playing in. Because that's what time it was then. You know, it was like everybody was playing clubs. You know, it was more about, that's how I met as many musicians as I met, because I was always around. I always was watching, you know, and that's how I kind of picked up on, you know, certain things and how to play and all of that, because I didn't go to school for it.
So how old were you when he realized, like, okay, you're good enough? And
well, what was deep was I got a chance to play with him. That was my dream, you know. Even before playing with James or anybody, you know, I wanted to play with my brother because I wanted to prove to him that I was worthy. Yeah, worthy. You know, seriously. You know,
it work?
It worked big time. I mean, you know, that one time I played with him, and what happened was, he was called to do a gig, a weekend gig, and the bass player couldn't show up. So, you know, I was like, yes, this is my chance, you know. And he was like, oh, no, you know. He's like, nah, not you. I'm going to get me a bass player, but it ain't going to be you, you know. So I'm like, oh, man. So he kept trying to get the bass player, you know. You know, it wasn't written. So, he said, okay, man. He said, but you ain't even got no bass. And I'm like, well, if you can get me 4 strings, I'll turn this guitar. I had a $29 guitar, silver tone. Mm-hmm. Never will forget it. James Brown blasted me out. I'll tell you about that too. Mm-hmm. But I said, you get me 4 strings, I'm going to turn this into a bass. This is going to be my bass. He said, okay, I get you 4 strings. It better sound good. I was like, it's going to be the bomb. You know, so he gave me 4 strings. I put it on that guitar, and that night played the gig. I mean, it was about the size of this room, full of people. I mean, everybody was drunk as a skunk. Okay, the Playboy Club. You got the upper end Playboy, right? Then you got the rat hole Playboy. Guess which one we played at?
You said the
rat hole.
Yeah, it was double rat hole. Okay. So we playing. I mean, I got Mugs all up in my face because I'm the youngest Mug up there. So it's like, and I, you know, they say I sounded pretty good. So, you know, I had to go with that. They all up in my face. And my brother's standing back there. He's playing the lead and he's watching. You know, I didn't know he was watching me like that. But after the gig, it was like, okay, man, you know, you're going to be the new bass player. Like,
you were that good, damn.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing, but, you know, he liked it. And that was the first time he liked anything that I did. So I was like, whew, yeah.
So
from that day on, we played together from there, you know. From then on,
your brother's guitar technique,
yeah,
probably the, I mean, next to Cenk Nolan,
yeah,
and Cheese Martin,
yeah,
and James Brown's arsenal. His guitar playing is like, was he always that good and that precise with his rhythm?
Always. George to this day will tell you that, you know, I mean, forget the drum machine, you know, timing. This boy was just so, Yes. You know, his timing was so much better than mine. You know, and both of us had pretty good time, but his was like exceptional. You know, he can turn around, everything can go off, the PA, everything, and Cat will still be having that thing going. You know, and Joe, and that happened to us a few times.
A fuse is blowing, and
yeah, and George just turn around, start smiling, and just, you know, because you got Catfish that ain't gonna stop. You know, and if you move, he ain't going nowhere. You know, he don't get emotionally upset or emotionally involved. He's just grooving. You know, he's doing his thing. And once he gets locked, it's on.
See, I knew his technique with timing was super important.
Yeah.
Catfish is probably his most iconic rhythm, in my opinion, is get on up, get into it, get involved.
Yeah. Yeah.
The infamous,
right,
which never, I mean, I've heard a gajillion live versions of that.
Yeah.
And he's the anchor.
Yeah. Yeah.
More than James's drummers, more than anything, like that's the driving rhythm of that song. So
you're right.
Yeah, I just always like, did he practice a lot or was it just like
he practiced a lot? But it was just a natural thing to him. He was chewing his gum. Every time he seen that mug,
yeah,
chewing his gum yeah, and hitting the guitar, wow. You know. And, you know, he first made his guitar, you know, because he went to Bloom Junior High, and they had a wood shop, you know. And he made his first guitar by hand, and he put these fishing strings on it. You know, this was before he knew what to do. Mm-hmm. You know, he just wanted a guitar, you know, and he made his own guitar and put fishing strings on it. And wasn't nothing happening. Once he found out wasn't nothing happening, then he realized he needed a guitar, you know. And once he got his first guitar, it was on. It was on.
Yeah. Did he ever figure out how to make one since he bought one? Did he ever go back to it? Because that's kind of fascinating.
Yeah, he didn't go back to that. Okay. You know, yeah, he didn't go back to that because, you know, it didn't take too long after he started playing that we got together, and the next thing you know, I mean, things just start.
No time.
Yeah, it start happening, you know. And, you know, I like people like Roger Troutman, Sugarfoot. All of us kind of played in the same circle, you know, in the same clubs. All the bands. It was so many bands.
Why were there so many? Okay, so our listeners should know that Cincinnati is kind of regarded as the funk capital of the United States. I mean, Ohio is regarded as the funk epicenter.
Yeah.
But Cincinnati in particular, why were there so many bands in Cincinnati? And Is it the effect of King Records and James Brown's operation being there and him recording at the time?
I personally think that had a lot to do with it because it made young musicians want to be like, you know, these people that's recording all this stuff in the, you know, in the studio.
Would he live there or would he, like, how often would you see James Brown on the streets?
Oh, man.
And this is before you joined him. I mean, like.
He would just random. It was a random thing where he'd come in, he'd stay two or three days, sometimes a week, you know, with the band. And, you know, our thing was we were so hyped on the band that they were our heroes because James was so out of reach that we just knew we wasn't going to meet him, you know. So, you know, our thing was if we can only meet the band, you know, Fred, you know, Maceo, yeah. Clyde, come on, man, Jabbo, you know, if we can meet, and that was our dream came true. But we met Bobby Bird, who treated us like, you know, we were somebody, and nobody knew us, you know.
Is that when you were the house guest, or
no? That was before. This is like Pacemakers, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, this is, I mean, nobody knew what was happening. We, first we met the Daps,
okay.
You know, And so we used to all be in that same circle. And so, you know, one thing kind of sparked off of another. You know, next thing you know, after the Daps start recording Over the King, some kind of way, oh, I'll tell you exactly how. Charles Sperling came down to hear us playing at a club, and he was like, man, the energy y'all cats got, we need that Over the King Records. And he was the A&R guy. Mm-hmm. And so he invited us over because he wanted us to be his backup band for his recordings and any production stuff that he does over in King. And so we agreed, you know, let's do it. Because we had never been in no studio, you know, not recording, you know. So we got a chance to start recording with him. Once we started recording with him, then Henry Glover and Gene Redd hit on us, you know, about recording with, you know, Arthur Prysock, Bill Doggett, Hank Ballard. So we was all on those records.
Wait, so that's do. Is that you on Honky Tonk?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, Bill Doggett, and then Soul Trees by Arthur Prysock, Hank Ballard. We actually went on the road with Hank Ballard. We went on the road with him before. Yeah.
Of course that's you.
Yeah. Oh, you're
because
ready.
You play half notes. Dun,
dun. Yeah.
Oh, you're ready.
So that's, who's the rhythm section? You, and who's drumming?
Damn, that's fun. I ain't heard that since we did.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I don't listen to.
See, to us, because it's been sampled.
Yeah.
Like, it's something totally different. It's the Beat Nuts.
Are you ready?
Right, but it's still, even in B-boy circles, like, that has been played millions of, you know, times in the last 20 years.
People always ask me about songs that I played on, and then I say, well, play it for me.
Yeah, because when you finish that sentence, I don't listen to what? You don't listen to your music?
No, I don't listen to myself.
You people play it at
them,
all.
People don't do
I don't
that.
I don't play with myself.
Yeah. Sometimes it could be healthy. Okay, all right.
Yeah, I mean, you know. No, I just, you know, it was always so much coming in that I never had time to just take a break and listen to what I've done. Because I was never interested in what I've done. It was always what's coming next. Because I always had something coming in, you know. And I tell you what it was. I was so full of it. Now, whatever that it was, I was full of it. I mean, full of it. You know, because, you know, we used to hang with the brothers on the corner. That was our whole thing. Music got a chance to take us out of that and give us a place where we can crack on ourselves. You know, it's like looking in the mirror and laughing at yourself. Mm-hmm. It's like it gave us a chance to do that with ourselves. You know, and I just happened to run into somebody that liked that approach, George. You know, now James was serious. That boy was serious. You know, so he kind of helped me because he was like a father figure that wanted me to be a certain way.
Disciplined. You know,
yeah, and I needed it. You know, we just coming off the streets with the riots, you know, throwing Molotov cocktails, stealing, you know, and we was a part of all that. And James reached in, pulled us off the street, put us in the band, and the next thing you know, man, we were in Africa with James Brown. And them mugs over there bowing down like we somebody. And we saying to us, hey, damn, we just played benefits in the clubs and ain't made no money. You know, now we with James Brown. You know, so it hit us like that. And we didn't have, just like the songs you're talking about, do I go back and listen? I never analyzed that part of how it felt with James Brown at that particular time. Because it was so unreal that I had no feelings. It was just deep.
Do you think it's also a danger? I tend to avoid favorites of whatever my audience expects because maybe there's a fear that you can't replicate that or do it again. I mean, like, okay, I know that in your job of doing concerts, yes, yeah. you have to do Bootzilla. You got to do, you know, right, Hollywood right. Squares or whatever. But just in terms of sitting back and listening to it, do you think it's more of a psychological thing of, because a lot of artists refuse to listen to their recorded work.
Yeah.
You know, because it might be too haunting of an earlier time.
Well, you know what? I think that's got something to do with it now. Mm-hmm. But when I was coming up, I was really too full of it to listen, go back and listen, you know, because I had made up in my mind I wasn't going to be listening to radios. I wasn't going to be listening to how people do this and how people do that. Once I got on a path, it was like, I'm just listening to the universe and what they tell me, what they send me, you know? And that's actually, that's the way I was feeling, and that's what was going on at that time. But after all of that time, now it's like, when I put stuff on, it's like, dang, you start feeling those feelings. Right. You know, it took all of that time, though, for me to get to this point.
Separation.
You know, to where it's like, if I put Rather Be On With You on, that's going to take me all the way back to not only what we were doing on stage, but where that actually came from in the first place and who I was talking to. You know, and then all of those feelings start coming up, and it's like, wow, I don't want to feel that, you know. So
that's understandable, because to us, you know, I think of a barbecue if I hear Body Slam, you know,
yeah.
my uncle's barbecue, you yeah. know. But for you, you could have been in a car accident a week before you recorded those vocals.
I'm going to tell you exactly where that came from. I was on the way to the studio, and what happened? A traffic jam.
Oh,
I'm caught up in this traffic jam. I was on the way to the studio to record that. And I was like, you know, and I was still coming up with, you know, okay, what's the, you know, I was still come. So I kind of had to leave my mind. I always had my mind open, because sometimes you don't get it until you right there on the mic. And then, bam, there it is. You know, but I was on the way to the studio to record Body Slam.
Wow.
And I got the lyrics. You know, I didn't know I was going to get the lyrics that quick, because I still had to record the song.
Right.
You know, but then the lyrics came. Said, I'm caught up in. I mean, the whole way I did it and everything came, you know, and I was like, got it.
Dude. You know,
and then when you get to the studio, see, you didn't have the luxury of,
dictaphones.
Yeah, you didn't have that luxury, you know. So it was like you had to remember. I mean, that's why we used our brains. Now you don't have to use your brain like that. You got smartphones to do it all for you, you know. But, you know, we had to put stuff in there and rely on that instant recall. Now, what was I thinking about this, you know, this song I was going to do, you know, and you had to recall that. You know, mm-hmm. And that was a thing that musicians had back in those days that I think is a lost art, you know, and you won't even be thinking about that. Well, you don't think about it too much now. No way. But 5 or 10 more years, that's going to be, you know, brain is going to be useless
thinking won't happen at all. Before I get to your James Brown chapter, I just have to know, just in the battle the band situation and yeah. all those local bands, what band unit scared you? Like, were the Ohio Players
Ohio Players.
Them
boys was the baddest boys in the world, as far as I was concerned, and as far as a lot of musicians, because anytime they would play anywhere, you know, it was like, the whole front line of seats would be nothing but musicians. And they'd be there. They'd be studying. There like this.
He's sitting with his hands on his knees.
And everybody knew. It wasn't like everybody's trying to hide. You know, everybody knew. I mean, these are the baddest boys. And I'm going to tell you something else. When they started making records, that wasn't when they were really the bomb. The bomb was when they didn't have no records and they just played in them clubs. That's when they was killers. I mean, them boys, I mean, you ain't never seen no show like this. You know?
Wow. And how old were they at the time?
They had to be like in their, I say, late teens, early 20s.
So Sugarfoot always had that voice?
Always.
Sugarfoot just...
Yeah, like his...
Well, he always had that voice, but he never used it like he used it on the records.
Okay.
You know, because it was always... they always had a singer that would do, you know, the singing part.
Right.
So Sugar, you know, he had that voice, but he never used it like that because they always had a...
someone else to sing.
Yeah, somebody else singing, you know.
Speaking of voice... All right, so we were working on a project, like 2003. I forget the project, but you played me a demo. You told me, he's like, yeah, of course. I had a dream about Jimi Hendrix, and I want to play it for you. And you played me the song, and then I had one of those Bootsy kind of the thinking black man memed, memed me pointing to his temple. I was like, hey, you know what? You kind of sound like Jimi Hendrix. Not totally going over my head that your whole voice is embodying Jimi Hendrix. Yeah. So how, what even gave you that thought to take on his...
Well, you know,
to
you
continue,
know
he, take the baton away. Like,
well, you know he was my hero anyway. I mean... and, you know, I used to have this room where it was about, okay, say half this room from there to here.
And we're in a very small room right
now. Yeah, very small. And then pull the rest of the room all the way up to here. Okay, so in that little box was my room. And I had a black light. I had a bed. And incense, weed, LSD.
You had me at black light.
Wow.
And an 8-track. Okay? And that's, you know, that's what I played. I played Jimi Hendrix. Jimmy's poster was up over the bed. Mm-hmm. Okay? And all you could see when you walked in my room, all you could see was that poster. You smelt the incense and you smelt the weed, and that's what I did, you know?
This is why I'm confused, though, Bootsy.
Yeah.
The weed, the LSD, but your memory is remarkable. Like, I just help stoners.
Yeah, yeah.
What is, how, I don't.
Well, it's just like I was saying how you retain stuff, and that was some kind of gift.
Wow.
I mean, because you really don't supposed to remember that
right.
kind of stuff. But I actually... The important stuff, okay? That to me was the most important memory, pretty much, of all.
True.
Was to be able to remember that. And I won't let that go. Mm. I won't let that go because it was one of the best times in my life. You know, I was finding myself. I didn't know what the heck was going on. You know, I'm sitting there listening to Howlin' Wolf, Santana, Jimmy, I mean, Miles Davis, I mean, you name it. And I'm sitting there, well, not just sitting, I'm, you know, doing something, you know, and it's usually, you know, me, my guitar or my bass, and I'm just sitting there and I'm listening and I'm freaking out, you know, and it was always a good freak out. You know, it was always a good
freak. That's a blessing.
So yeah, besides Ernie Isley, I just don't know another figure in black music that was young at the time that really absorbed Jimmy's essence.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess in the beginning I was just led to think that he was so freakish and out there that the black community really didn't embrace him.
They didn't understand.
But how did, you're in the inner city, how did it... speak to you.
It was my gift to not go with, you know, it's just like we was talking about the serious part of the blackness, and we took that and made not fun of it, but made it, you know, where you could kind of laugh about us partying on the mothership and, you know, acting a fool and having a good time. So we had to kind of take the seriousness and show people that we can actually have fun with this, with ourselves. You know, we can actually laugh with ourselves instead of, you know, because we was making it through this deepness, you know, with so much deepness going on. It's like, if we keep going this deep, everybody gonna be dead in a minute. I mean, because they're killing everybody. So we got to figure out a new approach. And it wasn't like we were sitting there analyzing the next approach. You know, the one gave us certain talents, and we just brought it to the people. You know, it's just like we took the street drug rap and made it funny. You know, P-Funk. The bomb. I mean, that's drug rap. You know? I
mean, now it's hitting
uncut.
Me. Yeah, right?
Uncut. Uncut funk. Yeah. That's all street drug rap.
So, can you describe? I'm glad your memory's there.
Yeah, me too.
I want you, because I have so many questions about the day that Bobby Bird came to get you guys.
Yeah.
To play with James Brown, which is essentially your
oh, you
your
know what,
your moment.
You know what, Quest? Let me I didn't finish on Jimmy. Let me just tell you how that came about.
All right.
What happened was we was in the studio, George and I was in the studio recording Be My Beach.
Right.
And I was in there clowning around, you know, and I said, "Yeah, Be My Beach, baby." And George said, "Oh, that's it, man. That's it." And I was just clowning around, you know. And next thing I know, George is like, "Go ahead, do that. That's the voice." And that is where it started. I was doing my imitation of Jimmy.
Okay, so, Laia.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
So, I'm explaining to you.
Okay.
That because of financial reasons, the team of James Brown, his band, decided that they were going to pull a mutiny.
Strike. We out.
A mutiny. The morning of a gig, I think it was around 11 in the morning, that we are not going to go on stage until you get the money straight that you owe us.
Because he was a real Republican.
Yeah. Hey, there you go. Yeah. So James decided to call their bluff.
Oh.
And he told his Ace Boone Coon, Bobby Burt, his AJ to his OJ.
AC.
Yeah. Oh, AC.
That was good though. Either way.
You know what I'm saying. Yeah. Sports. I'm bad with sports. To get on the Learjet, the private plane, and go to Cincinnati and go grab them kids.
Yeah.
And put him on the plane and bring him down here. So come showtime. Now.
So they broke the line. Y'all broke the strike line.
My question was, what parent in their right mind would just let their teenage kids like
go with James Brown?
All right, I'm out.
How teenage? What you mean? Like
he was 19. You were 19 at this time,
okay,
right?
Yeah.
All right.
So
yeah.
First of all, who is it, and how old were you guys? I would assume that your brother was the oldest, right?
Right. All right.
And if he's 8 years, yeah, he's 27. Like 27.
Yeah.
Okay, so give me everything. What time did Bobby Bird come to the club and tell you guys, stop what you're doing, come with me?
Well, actually, he called first, and we was playing a benefit. And, you know, we would get whatever come in the door, and didn't nobody know us. I mean, you know, so it was pretty much, you know, the fam, you know. And so we wasn't really getting no benefit, I mean, as far as no money. So when Bobby called, you know, I thought he was joking. You know, like, yeah.
What did he say?
He said, "Mr. Brown, want y'all to come down here and, you know, and play on the show." You know, so it wasn't like he wants y'all to come down here and play with him. It's like he wants y'all to come down here and play on the show. Mm-hmm. So it was like, oh man, come on, man. You know, yeah, man, I'm coming to get you. I'm coming to get you in 45 minutes on James Learjet. And so y'all just be ready, you know.
Damn.
And I'm like, okay. So I go back, I hang up, because I'm still thinking he's joking, but I go back and tell the boys, you know, I tell Kat, you know, like, Bobby, I just got off the phone with Bird, and he said James wants us to come down and play on the show. And so everybody's eyes lit up, you know. It was like, oh, man, he got to be joking. It's like, nah, man. I say, he said, well, you better go tell Mama, you know, because Mama ain't going for that, you know. And I said, well, if you go, I know she won't have a problem with it, you know. So call Mama, and, you know, I asked her. I said, Mama, you know, we got an offer to go down here and play, you know, on James' show.
Where is the
gig?
Columbus,
Georgia.
And you're in Cincinnati.
I'm in Cincinnati.
How far is that flight wise? Like,
you could probably make that in like 2 hours, maybe. I mean, now.
So what time is it when you get the call?
He had a Learjet.
I mean, it go fast. I never understood the Lear part. That means faster.
I thought it was
right?
His private. But well,
no. They don't fool around. Them boys go straight up into
that's
the
speed.
Air. They don't, you know, they don't.
James Brown was that famous back then?
Oh, yeah.
Like, I just got to maybe private jet status, like,
last year.
Yeah, no, he was that famous, you know. And that was the first time we ever got on a plane, you know. So he actually came, Bobby Bird, and, you know.
What time was it?
Damn. Let's see. What time was it? Now, see, that's where my memory.
You forgot that.
I wasn't clocking
it
in on time.
It was 2:52 in the afternoon.
What was he wearing?
I don't know. Right. I'm just thinking.
He was trying to think, how did they make the gig in time?
Okay,
I'm getting ready to tell you.
Okay.
I'm getting ready to tell you.
Cumulus
so,
clouds.
So it had to be around, I would say, at least 6, 7, somewhere around in there. And when he actually came and got us, we went straight into the limo, straight to the plane, straight up in the air. It wasn't no, you know, wasn't no fooling around.
What about luggage and your?
Oh, we just took our instruments. You know, that green bass I was telling you, that $29, that's what I had.
Wow.
And I'll tell you about. Remind me to tell you about what James thought about that bass.
Okay.
All right. So we. We get there, okay? We land, we get there, we go to the auditorium, and then we hear all this ruckus going on, rioting kind of vibe, which we were used to, but it's like we didn't realize it was directed at us, you know? And, you know, because the band is late. Well, there the band is, and they pointing at us, and we like, we didn't know. We didn't even know. Wait, we was walking into that.
Did y'all walk into the front door or backstage?
Well, we was getting ready to walk in the front door.
Wait, you were gonna walk into James Brown's famous enough to be in a theater?
Yeah.
They didn't think, hey, let's go through the backstage door.
Not yet. Not first. They was just going. You know, they wanted to show the people that the band had arrived because they didn't want to put it on James.
Okay,
it's the band's fault.
Oh,
you know. Now, see, we ain't gonna even have to tell you it's the band's fault because here they come. Here they come through the front door, you know. And we fools.
James is sneaking.
I mean, we fools. We don't know what's happening. We don't even know that we're actually playing with James Brown.
He didn't tell you that.
No,
they told us that we were coming to play on James' show.
But wait a minute.
But it's the review.
You mean during that 2 hour? During
flight,
that
two-hour
flight,
no.
Bird's not going
James,
over parts
James
and none of that stuff?
James told Bird, this is what I'm guessing, that he better not say nothing about they coming, you know, coming down here to play with me. Just go get them. that was you know, that's what I, that was my take. Okay, and then I found out my take was the truth when I got down there and we start walking through the band. Once we went around, because we couldn't come through the front, they was too deep, they was gonna start some serious, you know. So Bird took us around to the stage door. We went in the stage door, and the next thing you know, we start looking around, and the vibe, as soon as we got in the door, the vibe changed, you know. It like jumped on us, like, okay, something is wrong. We didn't know what it was, but it's like something is wrong. And then I looked over and I saw Fred and Kush
looking at you like,
no, okay, not looking at me. They still arguing at James.
Oh wow!
They arguing at James. You know how short, you know, James is. Well, uh-huh. They looking down at him, and it's like, you know, it to me it looked like they was getting ready to choking.
Oh,
or do something, you know, and I was like, what is that all about? He's like, oh yeah, I was gonna tell y'all.
Oh wow.
I was gonna tell you. That's why I wanted to get y'all back in here come on, we need to go into James Brown dressing room because we need to talk. So he takes us back in James Brown dressing room. Next thing you know, James comes in, you know. Fellas. Yeah. Glad y'all made it. You know, I need y'all to play my set tonight. And we like, huh? You know, we ain't rehearsed. I thought we was gonna open it. No, son, y'all playing on the James Brown show. Y'all playing tonight. And I said, well, how we gonna know what to play?
Yes.
You know, he said, well, when I do like this, yeah, I'm going to call out the song, Cold Sweat. And that's the way we did it.
I love the way he assumed y'all do it.
Right.
I got questions.
Y'all know these jams. Play this shit.
Yeah. All right. Yeah.
Two questions. Was his music so inescapable that you guys as a unit just knew it, like you knew Mary Had a Little Lamb? Like,
yeah. Yeah. What it was at that time, you got to realize that James was the hottest mug, you know, black performer. It was. I mean, and all the bands, every band knew his stuff, you know.
That's
or
amazing.
At least attempted to play.
That's something that would never happen again.
Do you know how cocky that is? Like, I know they know my material.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That's.
Yeah.
Like, who is that of today?
No one. That can never happen. That will never happen again.
It not only will it never happen again, but when I get with these artists, like Stevie Wonder don't know half his songs now.
Right.
Like, it's the opposite. We got to remind them. Shaka Khan don't remember, you know what I mean? Like, it's the opposite.
Yeah.
And then if I said, play this Beyonce song right now.
Nah.
All right.
Nah.
I'll fake it till I make it.
Yeah.
So, okay. And my second question is that funk wasn't invented yet.
Right.
You guys have yet to do. Sex Machine is a week later.
Right.
So.
Like literally a week later.
Yeah.
And so the thing is that the transformation of his music from the suit and tie soul thing.
Yeah.
Into the gritty,
right,
down and dirty
street
funk shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
How, first of all, did the audience buy it?
Oh, they freaking loved it.
Okay.
They love.
And how did you interpret those songs? Like, did you just approximate it as his band would have done it?
Well, you got to understand, too, that we needed to be polished. You know, I mean, we came in with what we came in with, and that's raw energy, raw talent, which needed to be put on the one, as James would call it. And, you know, me not being a taught bass player, I really didn't know the purpose of the bass other than, you know, just play these low notes, you know? But I played them like it was a guitar because that's what I learned on. And James was responsible for telling me that, all right, son, look here. Now, I love all that stuff you're doing there, son. I love it. But the only thing you got to do, if you going to play with the James Brown show, you got to give me the one. That's what I need, son. I need the one. You can play all that other stuff, but I need the one. Can you hit me with the one? That's where the one come from. So I learned the one.
The one was birthed, you said?
The one was birthed. Yeah.
What?
Okay, every member of the Roots, I want you to listen to this again. Can you say it again? Because there is...
It's all about the one.
There are
can
no...
You, can we explain to the listeners what the one is?
Like, it's an establishing pulse.
Yeah.
In music, you got to have a four count. Yeah. One, two, three, four. Now, for soul music, even though the emphasis is on, you might hear the snare on the tune of four. One, two, three, four.
Right.
One, two. It's that boom. Yeah. What is first? That is what hits you. Yeah. And oh my God, what's wrong with my voice? Mm-hmm.
Dairy.
Dairy.
Wait, what'd you say?
Dairy.
Okay. And the thing is that it's a certain repetition, like African drum repetition. There's joy in repetition. I'm just avoiding saying that.
It's like I was trying to think of like I don't want nobody to tell me nothing. Well, I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Boom. But dun, 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 dun. Like the one is less underlined.
How do you not have a one? I don't understand how you don't have a one. Like you got to start somewhere. So how was
distortion and static doesn't have a one?
Which is why
that one right.
I'll give you a better example. Okay. Well, here's weird. This is what's weird. Technically, 7779311 doesn't have a one.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I'll even make it easier for you. The Whisper Song by the Yin Yang Twins doesn't have.
It just starts.
Well, most snap music has no hi-hat. Uh-huh. You need a metronome. You need something that establishes the pace of a song. You need a metronome.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Now, you know, not every song is going to have a. Like a one, two, three, four, but it's insinuated in your head.
Right.
Yeah.
You don't realize it, but you're being hypnotized every time a loop happens. Mm-hmm. So think, James Brown's music really isn't a linear structure of song. Like think of like John Coltrane or jazz. Mm-hmm. Jazz is linear. Mm-hmm. James Brown is circular. Mm-hmm. And he has a whole bunch of people playing repeated notes all over again.
Yeah.
P-Funk is even crazier because they'll have counter stuff.
Yeah, right, and counter melodies.
Y'all all over.
Yeah. But repeating the same thing over again.
Yeah.
So by the seventh minute, like, don't stop till you get enough. Mm. You remember how shit just breaks down to the end? Mm-hmm. It's just stuff playing over and over and over again. Shake your body down to the ground. Another example.
And that's a loop. That's like a one bar.
Yeah, there's
boom,
no...
Boom, 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 boom. That's it. Like, that's the song.
So the one is just, it's just, it's it needs to be super obvious sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with my band, you know, and this is the one downfall of worshiping Jay Dilla, because he kind of throws out the manual of meat and potatoes rhythm.
Yeah.
And it's causing a lot of cats, like Thundercat, Chris Dave, a lot of post- Jay Dilla disciples to just
kill
disregard
the one?
Numbers.
Oh, wow.
I call them the time stretching drummers.
That sounds almost sad, though.
I mean, no, it's it's like Thelonious Monk sort of having sub notes. Right. I mean, it's creative.
Right.
But the thing is I believe that you should study the Old Testament
to create,
master it, and then you expand.
Yeah. You learn the rules before you break them.
Like, right. You just got cats coming and breaking the rules and then like... Still,
with no foundation.
But even still, when you listen to like Chris Dave, he still comes back to the one.
No, well, Chris is a genius, but he has a lot of disciples that are just like watching his YouTube videos and then just going from that. But, you know, and it's... The one is important. The one is... It's meat and potatoes. There's something really cool about the Sex Machine session that I guess, well, Boss Bill and I were alerted to it because we have the the Pro Tools, the master reel. And
I do.
do we not occasionally teach at NYU, Bill?
Yeah, but I don't have the sex machine reels.
Well, you know, we share every. I mean, come on now.
Like, I have them, and
what
you
kind of yours
sometimes
is maybe mine. But my the point was that you guys did two takes of it,
mm-hmm.
and the kind of in between banner. I guess there's like a 2 or 3 minute break between take one, which was the master take,
right, right,
and take two, which was like, let's just get a second one for safety's sake. And every James Brown expert that's ever heard that, their jaw dropped, because their jaw dropped simply because of the nurturing kind of tender father-like way that he's communicating with you guys.
Yeah.
Whereas with anyone else,
he hollering.
either Ron the engineer.
Yeah.
Or you know, whatever. He's just like, nah, man, that was wrong. And even in, you know, Give It Up or Turn It Loose, you hear him like, starting all over again, like in the song, right. You know, that sort of thing. But he actually stops and says, no, you know, no, do it again. You can make it work. You know, no, you're doing good. Just they've never heard James Brown actually
be nice.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah. So was Sex Machine the first time that you guys were in the studio, or like, was that your first professional?
You mean with James or?
Well, I know that was your first with James. Was that your first with James?
Actually, no.
What was before that?
What was the first time I played with James? Of course, he didn't use it, but his band took a break while they were recording Lick and Stick.
Okay.
Wow.
And yeah, most mugs don't know nothing about this one.
Yes, we do.
Yeah, I know Lick and Stick.
No, I mean with the story.
Okay.
And so his band went on a break, and James get this horrific idea. And, you know, we outside, you know, me and my brother, you know, the band. We outside, always outside, waiting on a chance to get in, because they didn't let nobody in. You know, it was like, we don't care who you are. You know, nobody's coming in but James and who he needs. And so his band.
Wait, y'all would just be outside?
Outside the studio, hanging.
Like listening.
Listening,
like
hanging.
Like the cowboy downstairs waiting for us.
Yeah. I mean, every time James came to Cincinnati, we was there. And so, you know, he said, man, I know Bootsy and them out there. Go out there and get Bootsy in. Next thing I know, they opened the door. Bird say, Bootsy, come on in here. And we were shocked. It's like
the golden ticket.
We were shocked, but at the same time, we was all waiting for that. Right. You know, because before that, he ain't never called us in the studio. You know, so he called us in. I want you to play this part for me. It goes something like this. I said, you mean? Yeah, son, that's it. That's what I'm talking about.
Yo.
What?
Yeah.
That's
what
I'm talking about. Describe a session. Dude, describe it. That's how songs would get made. He would just sing something, you would have to decipher what he really
means. It was like, you from here, America, you go to Japan, and they don't have no idea what the hell you talking about. But if you play it in music, they can sing it.
They understand it, yeah.
Okay, so James's whole thing is when he's communicating with you, you don't know what the hell he's talking about.
Sounds so African. That's crazy.
So that's what you're going on. Oh, you mean do. Yeah, son, that's what I'm talking about. Glad I thought of it. That's the way it works. That's the way it works. And you was glad he thought of it too.
Yo,
because just
good,
being
boss.
In his presence was enough for me. And then the mugs tell me, "You mean you didn't get paid for that? Get paid? you know, we wasn't thinking about getting paid. You mean your name ain't a name on what? You know, we was just so inspired, lifted from being in this cat's presence. What nobody think at that time, you know, you got to remember what time that was. You know, that was like, you know, writers, mm-hmm. publishing, all that stuff was unheard of for musicians. You know, you'd be lucky to come in and they give you $25 or $30 for a session.
Wow.
You know, and don't even speak about you done wrote some, a bass part, or you done, or Jabbo done came up with a drum part or clacking. No, that belonged to James Brown. You know, couldn't nobody tell Clyde to play that
funky drummer or whatever. Yeah,
play that funky drummer like this. Yeah, let me show you how it go. And James used to do that. Let me show you how it go. And he'd get on there and play some 4/4.
Clyde told me he would get on the drums and play totally.
Ain't nothing
something.
Happening. Right. Ain't nothing happening. But see, the thing is, I don't want to make it sound like, you know, he was that far gone. He wasn't gone at all. He knew what he wanted, but you had to give it to him.
Right.
You know, you had to. He knew it when he heard it. You know, it's like, you know, if you didn't play it right. No, son, you ain't got it. No, that ain't gonna work. No. He'll give it to you like that. But if you play it, if you play what he wants to hear, yeah, that's it, son. That's it.
So I know that you guys were wet behind the ears, just being thrown in the situation.
just to say the least.
So. What were the, because Alan Leeds told me that there was a lot of rigorous hours of rehearsing. And
oh man.
What were the rehearsals like? And actually, why did Clyde and Jabbo cross the picket line? Or,
oh, you mean come back?
Yes.
I don't. You know what? I never even thought about that. And I didn't ever look at it like they crossed the picket line. It was like,
The band left, and then Clyde stayed.
Yeah, but he came back. Clyde came back.
Okay.
He didn't actually leave when the band left. He came back about maybe a couple weeks after we started getting things together.
Okay.
Jabbo is the one that didn't leave. He stayed. So, you know, but Jabbo was that kind of loyalty guy, mm-hmm. that, you know, he was like Bird, kind of like Bird, Bobby Bird. He wasn't going to leave James, you know. At that particular time, it was like, you know, Jabbo was like, this is it, you know. And he was the foundation for us, because he was the only one, well, him and Bobby Bird was the only one that was there the first couple of weeks that we could rely on. It, you know, that kept us steady.
That's another question, because your style is your James Brown style then was pretty much James Jamerson on steroids,
right? Right.
I mean, you're going all over, and I know you're saying like James just wanted that one. You could do all that other stuff,
yeah.
But someone had to be the bad guy to say you're playing too much. Like, you guys are virtuoso musicians,
yeah.
But who's the person that has to reel it in and say, yo, you're playing too much. Just give me
the James would be the bad guy. You know, he didn't need no help on that.
That's what I was thinking.
You know, it was like, but he liked what we was doing. You know, he just liked it. I mean, we heard all of the stories, and we would see how he treated the other guys. But with us, just like you were saying about that story about how he nurtured us, you know, that's the kind of father figure he was to us. Finding us, no. Finding us didn't work because we didn't have no money anyway.
Right.
So it's like, yeah, take my money. I mean, you know, take whatever you want. I'm here with you. You know, you can have my money. It don't even matter.
So he did kind of slightly take advantage of y'all being younger with the whole the pay cut thing, I'm imagining, since, you know, everybody else didn't come back.
Well, I wouldn't even say take advantage.
That was just the law.
That was just what he did. You know, okay. That's what he did. You
I'm changing
around. When he get to a certain point, it's like if, and he could be just going through a thing where he feels like he need a change.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
And if he need a change, then he'll start a ruckus, you know, and say, man, funk y'all, you know? So, you know, they had me going in asking for raises when I didn't even feel like a raise. I mean,
y'all just got here, right?
Yeah, we just got here. We having a great time. What is wrong with you people?
But the thing is that it seems amazing enough, but you guys were only there for less than, you were there for 11 months.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
in that time,
everything that you guys did was some life changing funk. Like next to Sly Stone, I mean, you guys single handedly like rewriting the book of what soul music was. What was the last gig like before you guys were like,
oh,
did
I know.
James let you guys go, or was it you guys said we have to go? Or
you would.
No, I don't know. I never knew what the last gig was.
It's funny. The last gig was here in New York at the Copacabana.
Okay,
we was there, supposed to be there for 2 weeks. Okay. Right, we had just came back from Europe. We had did 2-3 weeks over in Europe. We had did a couple of weeks over in Africa. Right. We come back. And the first gig that we do is the Copacabana. So we play for a week. We're supposed to be doing 2 weeks. We play the first week, and but the trouble started over in Africa before we got back. The trouble started with while we went to the president. What was his name?
Mobutu? Not Mobutu. This was the Rumble in the Jungle.
This one was the president of Zambia.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, we went. He invited us to his. You know, it was kind of, it was like the White House thing. So he invited us there, and what happened was there's been some rumbling going on about we need a raise. You know, and so I'm the Mikey. You know, I'm like Mikey. You know that commercial? Like, let's get Mikey to do it.
right.
So I was always the Mikey character where they tell me what they wanted, because James was always kind of soft with me. You know, you can get away with it. Okay, yeah, you know.
You really were his son.
Yeah. And remind me to, well, maybe I shouldn't tell that story. Okay, but anyway.
You should absolutely tell that story.
You should.
No, it's kind of personal with his, you know. Right. But so we go to dinner, and they say, Boosie, you going to tell him? You know, you need to tell him now. You need to tell him now because we with the president. And we want to embarrass him right
what?
Now.
What? Yes. No.
So check it out. Yeah. That's what I said. You know, you need to go tell him now, because we got to play, you know, after we leave the dinner, we got to go play. But you need to tell him now so he can agree to it, you know. So, and I ain't going to tell the names that told me this to do this. Mm-hmm. But so I said, okay, I'll do it. So I went and told him. And, you know, actually, I didn't tell him. They wrote it down.
Oh, Lord.
They wrote it down. They gave it to me. Okay? Take it to James. James down on this end of the table, and then you got the president on the other end of the table. You know, and everybody else is sitting, you know, around, right? Long table.
Mm-hmm.
So I gets up. I go down. I hand the note to James. Okay? He said, what's this here, son? What do you know? Well, the band just want, you know, just read it, you know, and let us know what's happening. You know, He knew I was full of it. He knew it, you know. So, you know, once he read it, he jumped up from the table.
Ah! Oh, shit.
You mother.
In front of the president?
I knew it. No fucks given. I knew it. Y'all coming at, y'all got Boozy doing all this shit. I know it ain't him.
Good.
I know it ain't him.
Good.
And y'all ain't got but one more time to try this. He said, and that's going to be it. That's going to be it. So, you know, well, you know, the whole thing was, well, do we get a raise?
You know? do we still get it?
Yeah. All right, I'm going to give it to y'all this time.
Awesome.
I'm going to give it to you. But don't try it again. And so that stuck in my head, you know, don't try it again. Mm-hmm. So we get back from Africa. Everything's cool. It was a blast, man. I never could imagine what Africa was really like unless I had really been there. You know, I was thinking Tarzan, you know, the animals, Jane.
Did y'all go to Nigeria?
Lagos, baby.
Oh. Did you go see Fela?
Did I go?
Oh. Yo,
did I ever come home?
What was that like for you to see him in his prime then?
Man, I mean, words can't even do that justice. Words can't do that justice, man, because, okay, I got a story, man. But
yes.
Yes.
Oh, come on, y'all.
Yeah.
It's Fireside Chat.
Okay. Go ahead. All right. So, we on the way to see Fela, right? All right, we off one night, so we on the way to see Fela. And then at this time, you got to understand, in Nigeria, the police was the army. It was an army. Serious. They didn't play. I mean, with nobody. You know, it's like, so we in the car, riding to the gig, and I'm like, you know, we in the backseat, we smoking, you know, and... Of course, I got the weed, right? I got the bomb.
Nigeria, Boosie?
Yeah, in Nigeria. Oh, I got friends everywhere.
Okay.
Talk to them. Yeah. Talk heavy.
Yeah. I got high friends in high places and low places.
Yes.
And even lower than that.
Yeah.
So I got the weed, you know, and, well, I ain't going to call no other names because y'all already know I'm guilty.
Yes.
So I I'm passing around and... And so all of a sudden, this car pulls up on each side. One pulls up on this side, one pulls up on that. And get out the car. And, you know, we're looking at each other because we don't know what's going on. Only the driver knows what that means.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, get out the car. Well, he didn't say get out the car like in
English.
Yes, yeah.
whatever the language was.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now so, we've offended the continent.
So, yeah, we didn't know what was happening. So you know, the driver looked at us and said, won't you step out? You know, step out. So, and I'm looking at this person saying, what do I do with the weed?
Right.
You know, she said, put it in the boot. I was like, oh. Then I snuck it, put it in my boot, and then the driver said, no, open the boot.
Oh, the trunk.
Check it out. Open the boot. I'm like, how did he see me put that in my boot?
Why he telling?
Wow. Yeah. And so next thing I know, the driver got out, opened the trunk, and I was like, and then this other person said, he meant the trunk. Man, my heart, you know, my heart jumped out the one that was on the floor. I didn't know what, you know, because the stories of what these cats would do to you, you know, it's like.
Brutal.
Oh, man. So, you know, when he said the boot meant the trunk.
Right.
I was like, okay, cool. Then he checked the trunk, nothing, you know, because we had everything on us, you know. And so after that, he said, okay, y'all can go, you know. And I, right there, I was through, you know. The only thing that saved me was the rhythm of the drum. Mm. you know, the closer we got, the rhythm of the drums, because that's what drove me out of the state I was in after What's in the Boot.
Right, because it fucked up your high.
Oh, man.
Fucked up your high.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. Mm-hmm. So we got down to Fela's place. He had a this big, big room. It's kind of like back in the gladiator days where there was no roof. So you couldn't tear the roof off. The roof was already tore off. It wasn't no roof. And all you can hear when you're on the way there is the rhythms. Man. It's the rhythms, you know. And actually, that's where I put in my memory bank that beat. If you listen to Stretching Out, which I know you have.
Yo,
look at your face.
This is the quietest I've ever been in any question.
That's where I got the emphasis of that. And I saw the females dancing.
Did you know of Fela's music ahead of time, or
I had no idea.
Oh man!
So tell us when you walked in the door, like, oh my god, what you saw must have freaked you.
Well, it was before I walked in the door. Oh. We was already freaked out. Like I was telling you, the rhythms. I mean, that was like, you know, and the way they was treating us was like we was gods. Yeah. And I'm like, y'all got this twisted. You know, I'm saying to myself, you mugs got the gold. You know, and of course I told them that, but they didn't, you know, they was like, no, it's y'all, you know, because they praised James Brown.
Right. Was he with you? He was with you guys?
He wasn't with it. No, okay. Now you got to remember, this was after, you know,
the Rays.
The Rays.
Right. Oh.
So he was mad, you know, I'm mad. So he wasn't going down there with us. At first, he was going before that.
Yeah.
But no, he saw us later, you know, and I can dig it because it wouldn't have been cool, you know. We couldn't have been smoking.
Had no fun,
you know, no fun at all, you know. So it worked out really good. Got to meet Fela. He played. He did the horn thing. He sung, and the people. I mean, it was just, you know, it was something like I never experienced since. I say it like that.
I believe you.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it was all natural, all raw, you know. And then he invited us back to the room, and we had these little, you know, the little joints, you know, I mean, seriously, you know,
and this shit too, huh?
And
expensive shit.
I mean, it's like, what are y'all? And it was like an insult to offer, you know,
your little bit of whatever.
Oh man, you know, it's like, okay, I'm putting this away, because it was massive, man. I mean, it was massive, and we stayed pretty much all night in that room after they came off stage. It was a blast.
What time did they come off stage?
Did they come see you? Yeah. What was it like for them to see the James Brown show? Because
it was the same kind of, you know, the same kind of experience for them, you know.
Because I know that Fela Kuti worshipped James Brown.
Yeah,
and
yeah, it was the same. It was that same kind of vibe we had when we saw them. That's why I couldn't understand personally myself why they was so. Well, I understood it, but at the same time, it was like, we are nothing compared to what y'all are doing, you know. And they couldn't
fathom that.
They couldn't fathom that.
Because the I think that just the myth of America, and what it's supposed to represent is larger. The idea of America is larger than
its
byproduct. So you guys flew home to the Copa after that.
Yep, right after that.
And what happened?
We did about 2 or 3 gigs. Because we had six, seven shows and 2 on Sunday because we had to do the matinee. Uh-huh. Okay, so James was gonna cut the salary, okay? And we were playing 7 days and twice on Sunday. And he decides to cut the salary. And the same people came to me like, we can't let him do this. You know, you got to go in there, Mikey. And you got to get it straight, man. You know, and I'm like, what the problem is, mm-hmm. you know?
We working. We
yeah, good. I mean, you know, I got all these girls and, you know, I got my weed and I got my LSD. I'm cool.
What else do I need?
Yeah, you know, I ain't got no responsibilities. You know, the only responsibility I have is playing, you know, because I love to play, you know? And so, you know, these mugs with responsibilities, you know, that's what they were really concerned about. You know, and I understood it after I got away, but while I was there, it was like, what the problem is, you know? And so they talked me into it again, you know, go in, saying, tell him either he pay us full salary or else we walk. And so I didn't feel good about it. All the other times I felt like, you know, you can go in and do it, you know? But this particular time, I didn't feel good about it. You know, I was like, to myself, I was saying, okay, now if I do this, you know, and if it don't work, you know, we walking, you know, the whole, you know, the band that came with me, we walking, you know. It's like, oh, he give you everything, buy you coach, your bass, he buy you all it, you know. I'm like, okay. So I go in there and I drop it on him, you know. He says, ah, son, I knew you was going to do it. I knew you were going to do it. They've been using you. They just using you, man. Ain't you see that? And I'm like, well, this is what they, you know, this is what they saying. Well, son, you know what? I ain't going to let you get away with it this time. You go back there and tell them they all fired. I ain't going for it. You know, he said, I know what they're doing to you. And, you know, you should know. So if y'all got to walk, walk. That was it. I went back and told them. And they was like, they started looking up in the air and stuff. And, you know, I'm like, I can't go back on my word. If I told a man I got to go, if he can't do nothing, then I got to go.
Called your bluff.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. So,
and then in my mind, it's like, okay, what in the hell are we going to do now? You know, because I knew that was it. You know, it's like, we got to go. So we sitting on the bus. We all, the whole band, sitting on the bus, you know, looking at each other on Trailway. I know we're
Trailway, right here, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember taking them.
But. Trailway bus, man. And, you know, we looking at each other. And then they looking at me like, okay, what are we going to do now since you went in there and, you know.
Messed
you,
it up.
Yeah, you messed it all up.
You didn't ask right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
you didn't ask right.
And so, you know, that was wearing me out. I started feeling like, dang, what are we going to do? So the next thing came to my mind is, you're going to go to Cincinnati, you're going to practice, you're going to get in that basement, you're going to practice, you're going to get tight, and you're going to go to Detroit, you know, and see what happens. Because, you know, that's what we were into, taking people's gigs.
Check this out, y'all. We got to continue next week with more Bootzilla.
Sorry you hate to see it done, but we got to do it. Come back next time for part two of our very strange journey with Bootsy Collins on QLS Classic. What's Love Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. This classic episode was produced by the team at Pandora. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.